Hello and welcome to episode 6 of every single sci-fi film ever. I'm Aisha Khan. Today we will be looking at Frankenstein, but we're going to be doing it a little differently. Although many people consider the 1931 movie to be the definitive film on Frankenstein, there are dozens upon dozens of them. So I thought we could take a look at the character Frankenstein, his monster, and about why these types of stories fascinate us so much. But before I get to that, I need to say a huge thank you. I have been so overwhelmed by the number of people, thousands all over the world, who have tuned into this podcast. Thank you so much for giving it a chance. Thank you so much for listening. It's amazing that there are so many people out there who are interested in very, very old sci-fi films. So if you've enjoyed it, please subscribe, recommend it to your friends. And if you want to follow me on social media, you can do that mainly on Instagram at every sci-fi film. Now on to our wonderful guests. Roger Luckhurst is a professor at Birkbeck University of London. He specializes in film, literature, and cultural history from the 19th century to the present. He has written/edited multiple books and written numerous articles on science fiction, horror, and the Gothic. Welcome, Roger. How are you doing?
I'm very good. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Wonderful. Joining him is Sarah Art, who is a lecturer at Edinburgh Napier University. She has taught courses on Frankenstein in film and television and co-led a three-year project titled The Age of Frankenstein that examined the origins and the legacy of the story. How are you doing today, Sarah?
Good. Yeah, really well.
Brilliant. Sarah, can I go to you for a quick overview of the origins of the Frankenstein story, the monster, and there's a lovely story about how Mary Shelley came to write this book.
There's a great story about how Mary Shelley came to write Frankenstein. So basically, before she becomes Mary Shelley, she and Percy Shelley basically are having an affair, and they end up on vacation with Byron, Lord Byron. And
so just to set the scene, this is two very accomplished writers in the UK in the kind of early 19th century. And Mary at this age is 16, is that right? 17?
Yes. So she's a teenager. And many of the hot takes on Frankenstein as a narrative emphasize the fact that this is a novel written by a teenager. And there are a lot of people who sort of claim that with a real sense of pride. And it is remarkable when you sort of think about it in that way. So yes. So Mary Shelley, before she becomes properly Mary Shelley, she's not married to, Percy Shelley, the romantic poet. They basically start having an affair. Percy Shelley is still married to somebody else, and they go off on vacation with Lord Byron, who at this point is extremely famous. People are obsessed with him. It's fair to say. So he's on vacation with them. His personal physician, John Polidori, is there, and Mary's cousin, Claire Claremont, who's also completely obsessed with Lord Byron. And they're all on holiday together in the Villa Diodati.
And this is where?
Switzerland.
In Switzerland.
Yes, by Lake Geneva. This is the year without a summer. It's 1816. And there have been eruptions at Krakatoa. And so it is completely messed up, all of the weather patterns. And they're there, and so they can't enjoy some of the things that they might otherwise have done in terms of enjoying the landscape. And one evening, there's a proposal for a ghost story writing competition. And the results of this are Mary Shelley begins writing Frankenstein. And some of the other outputs from this are John Polidori's short story, The Vampire, which is often credited with being the first appearance of the vampire in English literature.
I think there was some accusation, or there were some rumors at the time, that people couldn't believe that this story came, one, from a woman, and secondly, from a teenager.
Yes. Although Mary Shelley was a very remarkable person in many ways. She's the daughter of political radicals. You know, her mother, as you probably know, is Mary Wollstonecraft, who is the author of The Vindication of the Rights of Women. She was a great advocate for the education of women. She's often credited as being a relatively early feminist. She, of course, dies giving birth to Mary. And Mary Shelley, throughout her life, is understandably fascinated by her mother as a figure and fascinated by her mother's legacy. And so also, as a result of this, as being a daughter whose mother is not present while she's alive, she is raised by her father, William Godwin, and she is part of his circle and is, you know, educated in a way that a lot of young women wouldn't have had access to. And so that too is part of what makes her such a remarkable and inquisitive person. And that's also what part of what equips her to produce a work like Frankenstein.
And a work which, it's 1818 that it was first published, is that right?
Mm.
We've got two Frankensteins coming out next year. One from Guillermo del Toro, which will be on Netflix, and the other one from Maggie Gyllenhaal. I will never know how to say that name. That's more based on the film Bride of Frankenstein, but still the same characters. So it survived over 200 years, and people are still fascinated by this monster.
Mm-hmm.
Even in the films that have leading up to Frankenstein 1931, which have these scientists messing mm-hmm. with nature and creating things which are, an abomination. There's one called El Rowan, in which a woman is created and they take kind of a prostitute and a criminal and they make this woman, and she is, you know, she's an abomination. She's all the dangerous things that I suppose society fears women to be. Roger, you've done a lot of work on monsters. Can we talk a bit about what Frankenstein's monster or any monsters tend to represent in fiction, in Frankenstein, and in film?
Yeah, that's a huge question. I think, it's the central kind of question, isn't it? Because this monster must be doing something for us to, you know, appear in 1818, be on stage within a few years. There are 41 silent films that are based around Frankenstein. There are over 200 sound films since. You know, it's just enormous. There must be something about this monster. And I think quite a lot of people look at Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, that 1818 moment, as not only just a kind of gothic story, so it's about an eruption of this horrific kind of creature, but it's also getting rid of a kind of theological framework of the Gothic. So this used to be about sin and transgression and so on. Why it's important that we know that Mary and Percy Shelley are radicals is because they're also materialists. They only believe, in a sense, in the vital spark of life being a kind of biological thing purely. Percy Shelley gets expelled from university for declaring his atheism, right? So they're radicals. They're really interested in science and the potentials of science. And that's what I think the monster of Frankenstein begins to, in its creation, is tapping into a lot of those kind of fears. Right at the beginning of the 19th century, there are a lot of scientists who are beginning to think maybe the divine spark of life, the soul, if you like, is actually just an electrical pulse. And what would that mean? What would that mean for our whole framework of belief? There's lots of kind of anxiety around that. And here you have this kind of monster that sort of erupts on the edge of what is an orthodox belief. So that's what I try and think about in terms of monsters, is this sense in which, and it's very explicit in James Whale's script, is that, you know, what would it be like to go beyond the boundary? What would it be like to go beyond the norm? And that's really what monsters represent, is this kind of eruption of the of some kind of transgression of our normal view of things. So it's monstrous because it's, you know, no longer normal. It's abnormal. In the film, he has an abnormal brain. And it's this sort of transgression that allows us to explore the limits of what is acceptable morally, but also what we know, also what we might want to kind of think about going towards or actually preventing ourselves. Hence, we use the phrase Frankenstein science, because it's about being at the very limit of what we should perhaps or could do with technology.
Okay. And I just wanted to touch upon, before we go into the themes that are present in the film, I imagine this is talked about a lot, but what you said, Sarah, about, you know, Mary didn't know her mother and she had a great and then kind of less great relationship with her father. And I've only been researching this for weeks, so I don't know all the nitty-gritty details of it. But is it quite commonly held that there was, and also that the monster is quite a sympathetic character in the book. Is there quite a lot written about how it is supposed to be representing her own, like, anxieties and issues around her daddy problems or whatever that she might have?
Oh, yeah. There's basically... I mean, honestly, like, biographical readings of Frankenstein through Mary Shelley's life, I truly feel there should be a moratorium on those. They are convincing a lot of the time. But one huge pet peeve I have is, particularly when it comes to work that is produced by women, it always comes back to like, oh, this is a reflection of her personal life, or exactly, it's like, oh, this is written by someone who has daddy issues. And it's just like, who does not have daddy issues? You know, this is not a special thing, right? Like, all writers have daddy issues.
I'd like to apologize for bringing it up, but I literally finished reading the book yesterday, and so I'd already done my Mary Shelley research. And although I'm reading it, and I'm like, the way he's speaking to his creator, and the way he's kind of, and it's interesting because he is that boundary kind of dweller, which I imagine Mary, when she's now kind of ran off with Shelley at the age of 16 or whatever she is becoming a boundary dweller herself. So it's difficult not to read it in when you know about the life. And I assume that it would have been done to death, but yeah, I couldn't read it knowing that without seeing that in there.
Yeah, I mean, I always think they're really, I mean, it's, I agree with Sarah that it can be very limiting, but it's also so damn compelling, that kind of sense of, you know, she really didn't get on with her stepmother. So what did she do? Hang around her mother's grave a lot of the time. And it's quite often thought that she actually engaged in her first sexual act with Percy Shelley on her mother's grave, because it was kind of hidden by a willow, you know. So this kind of extraordinary things, and I think also, Sarah, we should probably talk also about just that whole catalogue of her pregnancies and the death of her children. This is not something we're not used to currently, but, you know, she had a first child who died in 1815. She had a young child when she was writing this. There were births and pregnancies, Claire Claremont around her in her circle. There was lots and lots of this kind of sense of birth anxiety and early death and, you know, creation and monstrosity and a kind of sense you would get perhaps of being, you know, these radical, immoral people who were being punished in some way for their lifestyle choices, as we would say now. So I think there's a lot of kind of very rich material there, but it is incredibly limiting, especially when you think that the Gothic, all of the Gothic, is quite often about these anxieties of reproduction. So it's not just Mary Shelley. She's actually hooking into a whole genre which is about men's terror, actually, of reproduction. So it really does appeal, I think, to kind of readers as a sense of, well, what if we could create our own, you know, creatures without this horrifying reproduction? But here's the vengeance that comes when you transgress that law.
Absolutely. And I think, and I love that story about how, you know, sort of Mary and Percy maybe like first like got it on her mother's grave, because this is why Mary Shelley is the ultimate goth princess. This is also why, you know, there's also the story about like after Percy drowns, she keeps his heart in her desk for the rest of her life. I mean, like, isn't that amazing? You know,
I feel like the goths I knew growing up really didn't have anything on Shelley.
They really don't.
Okay, let's get to the themes in the film slash book of the monster. So the frenzied, obsessive, mad scientist, is this just a fear of scientific progress? What's the root of this, do you think?
It's subtitle. It's a very important subtitle, The Modern Prometheus. And in a way, it's, you know, it's an echo of the classic story of Prometheus, who is the... He is the man who transgresses by stealing fire from the gods, and this kind of representation of knowledge, which is absolutely central to the James Whale film. Nearly everyone is carrying a torch in that film at some point, or that, you know, a cigarette is being lit, light, sunlight is kind of coming in. So it's all this sort of sense of the Promethean enlightenment, so this kind of sense of grabbing fire. But Prometheus is punished by the gods in a fairly gruesome way, tied to a rock, and, you know, his liver is devoured every day in punishment for his wanting to know too much. So that's the kind of classic thing. And then I would say that the key resource for quite a lot of this Mary Shelley stuff is both Faustus, so the myth of the Dr. Faustus, who again is someone who is secretive, reading too much, reading the wrong kind of occult material, and makes a deal with the devil, and is, you know, kind of momentarily gets his delight and pleasure, but then is punished for it. So I think that's kind of really crucial idea as well, just that kind of Dr. Faustus story.
For those who haven't seen the film, there is a normal brain that the assistant is about to collect, and that drops on the floor. And so he ends up getting a jar marked abnormal with an abnormal brain in it, which is supposed to be a criminal brain. But even so, he doesn't tend to show these kind of very criminal tendencies off the bat. I mean, they develop, but he is quite an innocent character who seems to be mistreated. So I think that's an interesting choice for a horror film. What do you think was the reason behind them not kind of going full horror with this?
Well, I mean, I would say that the word horror as a description of a film has not yet arrived. It's about around about 1932 that you start to get the category H for horrific. And if you look at the early reviews of these kinds of films that we now call horror films, they were known as weird films, so kind of a weird atmosphere. So they're looking for kind of atmospheres of things. And there's a very rapid moment in 1931, 32, when you start to get these iconic kind of gothic creatures being adapted. So, you know, Jekyll and Hyde comes a couple of months later. The Mummy comes 6 months later. We've already had Dracula in February 1931. So, you know, all of these kind of clustered together in a very short period of time. And that's what creates the horror film. And I think what both Mary Shelley and the film do is that this is always a tricky question about what's the relationship to the sin, if you like, that's happening. Because there's a kind of a moral arc that you can put over a gothic story, which sort of says, here is hubris and you're being punished in the end. So a kind of classic Greek model of tragedy where, you know, you overreach and you're pulled down. And what's convenient about that is you can also call that a Christian allegory as well. So, you know, don't transgress God's law, otherwise this is what will happen to you. So you've got a kind of neat moral. And actually what the film does, or rather what the Universal Studios do, is they put a preface on this where someone comes out, Edward Van Sloan comes out at the beginning of the film, just says, don't worry, this is a moral film about what it means to go against God, and it's all a bit naughty. And they put a kind of, they even put a last scene in as well, where Henry Frankenstein is redeemed in a way. He survives this rather than being killed at the end of the film. So they've kind of put the story inside this arc, which is a kind of moral arc about sin. But actually the great thing about the Gothic is the middle stuff. It's the transgression. It's the delight. It's the joy. It's the eruption of violence and kind of really extreme emotions. So you can do two things at the same time. You can get away with it by saying, no, it's a moral story. But then you can also indulge all of that kind of violence and sexual transgression that happens in Frankenstein. And you've got away with it. But actually the secret of Gothic and horror is that we like those middle bits, you know, which is all about the transgression. And I think that's the same with Mary Shelley herself. You know, she kind of puts a preface on this in 1831, which, which kind of tries to contain actually all of the radicalism of the story and its secular approach to life itself and materialism, and tries to turn it into a much safer kind of moral story. But of course you want to do that if you want to be a kind of respectable, safe person.
There is apparently quite a prominent theme of revolution in the book, and even Frankenstein potentially as kind of a representation of revolution.
For Mary Shelley and Percy Shelley, both kind of radical socialists, had been kicked out of England for their immorality, in a sense. They've eloped. Byron can't go back to England because he's this scandalous libertine kind of figure. The 1810s, when they are gathered together in the Villa Diodati in England, after the Battle of Waterloo ends, the Napoleonic Wars in 1815, there's an incredible economic collapse, and lots of soldiers return. They're incredibly poverty-stricken. There's lots of poverty. At the same time, factory industrial revolution is happening, but there are attempts to form workers' cooperatives and unions. They're being brutally suppressed, including by military force, suppressing these sorts of things. And Percy Shelley, particularly as a public intellectual, is kind of on the side of the workers, even though he's an effete aristocrat. He's kind of on the side of the workers. It's all about revolution. So inside the story, Mary Shelley has, I mean, this is the great thing about her monster, of course. It's always mute in the theatre versions and the film versions, not always, but mostly. Whereas what you get in the novel is hundreds of pages from the point of view of the creature, of the monster. And the monster is educated, learns how to read, learns history and so on by listening in to a book being read out in this kind of hovel in the middle of the forest, which just happens to be Volney's Ruins of Empire. And Count Volney was at the center of the French Revolution. He was one of the key people in the assembly that overthrew monarchy and that started the revolution. It's about basically all empires are pulled down and ruined. It's set initially Count Volney's conversation in Palmyra, those famous ruins in Syria, which ISIS attacked in the 2010s, because it sort of still represents a different kind of system of belief. So there's a kind of sense in which the monster is being educated as a revolutionary child of nature. So it has all of this potential, all of this brilliance of the human kind of mind, and yet he's being turned into a monster by the morality and the strict morality of society itself. So he kind of talks about, but it's your laws that made me monstrous. It's not that I am intrinsically monstrous. You did the same.
Okay, that's so interesting. I wanted to talk a bit about sci-fi monsters in general. Why do humans love monsters so much? Let's go to Sarah first about this one.
Well, I think we love monsters because we are monsters, I think, is on the one hand. I think this is one of the things that draws people back to Frankenstein and Frankenstein as a narrative, whether it is in print form or on screen. It's no accident that this narrative has been, taken up and read as, an allegory for oppression or for systematic oppression, whether that is, ableist oppression, racial oppression, sort of oppression on the grounds of, sexuality or gender expression. There are lots of different ways in which that narrative has been read and in which it resonates with readers and viewers in those various ways. So I think, sort of we like this idea of the outsider monster because that, that makes us feel seen in that sense. If you feel that you reside in that border place. The other reason why we're so interested in monsters is because very often the monster is just a repository for, the things that no one can deal with that finds expression in a variety of ways. So one of the things that I think is so interesting, for example, about the Alien franchise, the Xenomorph, as that creature, initially, you know, based on work produced by the Swiss artist H.R. Giger. And one of the great terrors of this creature is that it possesses a body which can essentially assault and impregnate anyone. Anyone is vulnerable to the xenomorph. Anyone can carry the seed of the xenomorph in the Alien franchise. That is terrifying, you know.
But there's also that kind of tracking through from, you know, the initial film in 1979 is about an absolute monstrous, horrifying other thing that kills or needs to be killed. But even by the third one, Ripley, the main central female character, has a kind of kindred relationship to the alien in some ways, that, you know, I feel like you've been with me my whole life, that sort of sense of being almost symbiotic with it, so that you know, the monster and us, as Sarah was saying, it flips at a certain point. I think there's a really key image right at the end of James Whale's 31 Frankenstein, where they look at each other through a flickering kind of gear in the windmill, and they're framed in exactly the same way, so they're completely identical at that point. They're staring at each other, they're looking at each other. The monster is you. No, the monster is you. And that sort of reverse shot thing, I think, suggests really powerfully that monsters are the eruption, in a sense, of us, you know, and as Sarah really put it really well, that kind of sense of that all we can't deal with is put over there. The whole element that James Whale pulls out is this kind of sexual hysteria, I think, because, you know, there's so much emphasis on, well, let's put the wedding off while I produce this gigantic kind of monstrous, horrifying other. And then, of course, you know, the famous line in the book is, I will be with you on your wedding night. And that sort of sense of in the film, you get a little ellipsis where it's suggested that actually Frankenstein's bride on the day of the wedding has been raped by the monster. Yes. And it's like yes, this is us, but this is our kind of, you know, horrific alien animal desire that I don't know what to do with as a neurotic scientist. So all I do is work in order to repress this stuff, and then here it comes, kind of, you know, rushing out. So monsters are always a kind of version of ourselves. I think that's the key idea.
And maybe also the boundaries of what it is in humans that pushes us to become those things. Like with Alien, there's always that thing of, is it Alien 2 or 3 where, you know, she's protecting her children? I think it's 2, Aliens.
Yeah, Aliens.
Yeah. And so it's the idea that, you know, what would a mother do to protect her children? How far would you go? And I think it's similar with Frankenstein or with a lot of these films, that, you know, at what point of being either treated badly or protecting someone you love or whatever it is, that you turn into the monster that that you're reading about. Sarah, when I asked you about the role of monsters originally in our brief chat, you had said that anxiety is central to why we have monsters. And we have covered it a little bit, but did you want to expand on that?
Yeah, I was rewatching the James Whale film yesterday, and there was a moment in the film that I particularly noticed and that I was very intrigued by, and I don't really remember attending to it quite as much in previous viewings for some reason. And at one point, Henry Frankenstein, and I think the creature is like imprisoned in the tower, and he's sitting with his and Henry is sitting with his mentor, Dr. Waldman, and he says to Waldman, he says, have you never wanted to do something that's dangerous? And he says it in this way that's almost, it's almost flirtatious. It's sort of like a dare. That to me really sort of sits at the heart of the, I think, the appeal of Frankenstein, is that Victor or Henry does want to do something dangerous. And he gives himself permission to do this. And then he immediately regrets it in a way. And he doesn't know how to deal with this new responsibility that he has given himself. And so it is a story about risk in that way. I like that idea about leaning into and going past that anxiety, even if the consequences are ultimately negative. I like the appeal of that in this story. a great deal. And I think a lot of Gothic and horror narratives are about that line. And I guess it's nice to sort of connect that in a way to maybe to sort of James Whale himself as a figure. Cause I was reading a little bit about him in Vito Russo's book, The Celluloid Closet, this morning. And I was thinking about this because I'd known for a very long time that James Whale was gay, but I hadn't realized that James Whale was openly gay in the 30s. He lived with his lover. Everyone who knew him as a friend knew that he was gay. And that was very unusual. So James Whale himself, in a way, is a kind of radical.
What I didn't know about James Whale was that he was a prisoner of war for 2 years. At the end of the First World War, so 1917 to 19. And there have been some quite compelling readings as well of him. You know, these kind of vagrant wandering around of these monsters, disfigured kind of creatures in the background is that reflecting a kind of post-war era? What Sarah is undoubtedly right, that there's a kind of, you know, sexual dissidence throughout the film, and even more in Bride of Frankenstein, which I can't recommend highly enough as one of the campest things.
I watched Bride of Frankenstein just a few days ago, and I absolutely adored it because it's got the humor in there. It's got kind of certain characters, and it's so camp and it's so wonderful. And I love that in The Bride of Frankenstein, the monster learns to have a bit of a smoke and a drink and just kind of relaxes a bit and chills out. It's nice because he's had such a tough time. So can we talk a little bit about other sci-fi monsters? I think, Roger, you have quite a lot to say about both Godzilla and in the pod people in Invasion of the Body Snatchers. I always thought that was a straight up the communists are coming kind of narrative. But you suggest there's more to it than that.
Yeah, sure. So monsters always mean more than they can possibly contain. That's why they're monstrous in some ways and why they keep going. So something like Frankenstein's monster means lots of different things at different times. And these figures become containers for particular social moments or conjunctures. And you can always ask the question. I always get my students to ask the question, you know, why is that so important then? You know, what's happening? What is it kind of representing? Why do you get a bunch of horror films in the early 30s? And again, why in the 50s? So the 50s is a really kind of key moment for the eruption of American B movies, but also, you know, Japanese Godzilla from 1954. And in a way, this is a kind of, it's not an allegory. It's not hidden. You know, it's explicitly about nuclear testing in the Pacific, which we know was having all kinds of catastrophic consequences that were suppressed. So in a way, it's working through the Japanese national trauma of being, you know, not only subject to the only state subject to atomic weapon use, but also the failure, you know, and the absolute catastrophe of the sense of honor that had been very important in Japanese culture for centuries. So there's a kind of a sense in which that monster represents all of that. And the 20 million sequels of Godzilla are quite often flipping the monster into a defender of Japan. So it becomes an incredibly sympathetic figure rather than having jumped up and down on a model Tokyo for 15 minutes in the first film. It becomes a defender against all these other kind of giant kaiju monsters, they're called in Japanese, gigantic monsters. So there's that. In the States, we also get nuclear anxiety stories, and you've got to bear in mind that the American government are trying to suppress information about the consequences of using nuclear weaponry, including denial of radiation and mutation, all that sort of stuff. They're not sort of explicitly saying this is a consequence. So where you go to is B movies, where they kind of erupt in these giant kind of, you know, ants in them, or the 50-foot attack of the 50-foot tall woman, you know, all the Incredible Shrinking Man, you know, scale and things are changing all the time. And with the Invasion of the Body Snatchers, which is this story about a town in California where people are becoming rather strange and emotionless, they're actually being replaced by pods from an alien race. And you know, there's an argument, quite a common argument, that this is the Red Scare again. So this is the era of McCarthyism and the kind of saying that there are hundreds of communist sleeper agents that are hiding all the way through the government and through society. You know, we need to kind of get rid of these people. And communism, of course, is the theories of identical people, identikit people. And that clearly is there. But there's also a huge narrative in the States in the 50s about the fear of suburbia and the boring conformity of suburban life, cookie cut houses, identical families, this sense of really oppressive social norms. So in a way, you can see Invasion of the Body Snatchers as both a critique of communism, but also a critique of kind of post-war capitalism as well. And that means that it's available to everyone, in a sense, to whatever your political views, to kind of see something in the monster which kind of articulates perhaps your particular anxiety. So that's why there's a little cluster around the 50s, because it's such a rich moment where there's lots of social events that are being filtered through horror tropes.
I wanted to touch upon a film that isn't always considered a monster film, but does have androidy, as far as I'm concerned, monsters, which is Stepford Wives. Now, it's interesting because it really depends on how you view women, I suppose. And there is this long history of viewing these ideal women as something to be aspirational for certain men. But for the vast majority of free-thinking women, it's just a terrible ideal. Any thoughts on the perfect woman as a monster?
Sarah, definitely one for you.
Okay. Well, again, this sort of, I'm going to connect this back to Frankenstein briefly, because of course in the novel the creature explicitly goes to Victor Frankenstein and says to him, I want you to make me a female companion. I need someone who has been made the same way that I am to basically keep me company. And if you do this for me, I'll leave you alone. We will go and live in the wilderness and I won't bother you again. And Victor is especially horrified at this request. And he, you know, he doesn't really want to do it. But at the same time, he's also, you know, terrified at the creature's power. The creature is so strong and is essentially stalking him. So he goes off to Scotland, like, thanks, you know, goes off to Scotland to a remote island, and he starts to make a female creature. He starts to make a woman, and he destroys this half-made creature because he says he fears that she will be 10,000 times more malignant than her mate. Oh, this anxiety of that somehow if the two creatures together might be able to produce a sort of a race of monsters. There's that anxiety. But I think there is this anxiety about, you know, there's this anxiety about the woman. You see it in Fritz Lang's Metropolis as well, you know, with the two Marias and everything. I guess there's a sort of interesting thing sometimes about the Stepford Wives is that they're supposed to be these highly manicured and subservient bodies, but they just don't end up being that. And so there's always this anxiety about like the masquerade of femininity and, you know, like this desire for it, but also this sense of like, wait, what does that conceal? Because femininity is all about the masquerade, or like that version of femininity is always about masquerade. It's always about concealing like the seething anger or, you know, sort of unbridled intellect that is like underneath all of that.
Why would you get the Stepford Wives in the mid-70s? You've got this huge second wave of feminism in America. It's an incredibly misogynistic film about the fear of women becoming free and autonomous from male kind of control or male ideas of what the ideal feminine should be. I mean, one of the fears of a pure materialist explanation of biology is that we are just machines. And then machines given a kind of electrical spark. And then in the 1920s is when the word robot is coined, and it's from the word slave. So it comes over from Hungarian, I think, Roberta, for meaning slave. So you've got a master-slave thing going on. which of course comes out in the relationship between Victor Frankenstein and the creature, which is who's the master and who's the slave. The big narrative of anxiety that we all have, AI right now, of course, is that we've created perfect slaves that have now potential to be autonomous and become our masters. So that's what sense of that's why Frankenstein remains so useful.
Okay, we did talk about the death of Frankenstein in the film. Roger, you had mentioned that the windmill on fire was sort of representative of a cross and that it could potentially be read as a kind of anti-right-wing supremacy that was happening in the US at the time.
One of the key anxieties in the 20s was the return of particularly African-American soldiers and the sense that they'd had, you know, got above their station in life by, you know, experiencing the world, but also being in the army. And so there was a really strong suppression, particularly in the South, Southern states, and then lots of kind of riots about the wealth that was beginning to accumulate, which was greatly resented by poor white populations. And so therefore you got, after W.D. Griffith's film, The Birth of a Nation, which kind of revives the KKK, Ku Klux Klan, as this kind of secret white supremacist society that's going to keep society in control. You do get in the 1920s, it's the peak really of the Ku Klux Klan and its racial kind of violence and lots of really horrific incidents of lynching and so on. And their signature was not only their white hoods, but also placing of burning crosses. And that's sort of, that's how the film, James Whale's film ends, is that the windmill, is put on fire by a mob that is doing mob justice against a monster that's killed a white child. And that, that you see in the, one of the last kind of, images is the windmill still turning, but on fire. So you have these kind of, this kind of cross sign on fire. Now, whether James Whale intended that as a kind of image or not is subject to debate. And I always offer it to when I'm kind of reading it like that as well. You know, what do you think? You know, is there a, are we overthinking this? Are we seeing too much here? Or is this part of the context in which James Whale, as an outsider in so many ways, is placing the creature as this kind of emblem of not just a kind of monstrous, abnormal, criminal kind of brain, but also perhaps in a both a sexual way, but also in a class-based way. You can see how many meanings this monster carries. That's why it's so rich and why we keep talking about it. So I see them as kind of quite parallel. I think James Whale is very brilliant in not kind of doing an 1810s thing, but doing a 1920s America thing, which is both picking up on the revolutionary politics of the potential of this story.
Right, Sarah, do you have any thoughts on the death of the monster and maybe some conclusions about the whole discussion?
Yeah, the other thing I guess about James Whale is that he was very much born into a working class family, and there's a sense of him as an outsider because he was he was very interested in art, and he, you know, left, you know, was basically, you know, made to leave school, you know, sort of as a teenager to go to work, and eventually started using some of his money to try to attend art school and everything. So there's also a sense of, apparently he's a very, very class conscious person. But yeah, I always find the ending of the James Whale 1931 Frankenstein really strange, because you know, we have it just sort of ends and you're just like, it's over.
You know? I don't think that the monster isn't given much agency. And that scene, I believe it was cut when he throws the young girl into the river, whereas in the book he actually saves someone from the river and gets misunderstood, and that would have been like more of a commentary on prejudice. Whereas,
yeah,
it's just such a fundamental difference, isn't there? Because Mary Shelley is a classic romantic Enlightenment person who thinks that basically we are born as a tabula rasa. You know, there is and we educate ourselves, we nurture ourselves, and this can be into greatness, but it can also be stunted and deformed by social inequality. So that's the kind of, you know, the idea of the education of us into greatness. Whereas the film, of course, from the beginning, predetermines that the monster can only be a criminal degenerate, as the lecturer says in his lecture. So that it's only ever going to be able to do criminal acts. And that's a direct kind of link back to late 19th century theory about biological degeneracy. You are born like this. There is nothing we can do about this, except perhaps eliminate you or breed you out of existence. Hence the whole kind of world of eugenics and the idea of, you know, good breeding and all that sort of stuff.
Or sterilization.
And sterilization, but also explicitly about class. And, you know, let's stop the working class from kind of reproducing too much with a welfare state. But let's also, you know, try and protect us from a criminal thing, which is in your inheritance. So there were lots of people who were researching about biological inheritance of criminal kind of mind.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of framework that you have in the film. That's very, very different from the optimism, actually, and the romantic kind of sublime possibilities you get in Mary Shelley.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, both of you. If there was anything you could recommend to people who are listening, and they are listening all over the world, which I find quite shocking, what would that be? Any thoughts on that?
I would certainly recommend Alistair Gray's Poor Things, which, of course, has been adapted to the screen by Yorgos Lanthimos, but I would definitely recommend the novel as well. Bella Baxter, who's the protagonist, you know, who is essentially the creature, is a really compelling and fascinating protagonist, and is a protagonist that's really hungry for the world and gets to have all of a lot of the experiences that Shelley's creature or the other versions of the creature don't really get to have. So I would recommend it for, I think, that reason. And the other film I would recommend that is a kind of Frankenstein iteration is Julie Ducournau's Titane, which is not for the faint-hearted, but it is an incredible film. And also it's a body horror film that won the Palme d'Or at Cannes like a couple of years ago. Like, incredible that a film in this genre, a sort of sci-fi horror, but also like incredibly a sort of incredibly tender story of like finding kinship essentially as well. Absolutely brilliant in so many ways, and so that's one that I would recommend, but only for listeners with quite a strong stomach.
And just to add, if you are faint-hearted, I would really recommend Spirit of the Beehive, which is a 1970s film by Victor Erice. It's an absolutely gorgeous film because it's basically from the point of view of a very small child who's seen Frankenstein too young. And it's about her imagination of that kind of really horrific scene in James Whale, you know, the child gets killed. But in Spirit of the Beehive, she fantasizes about becoming the friend of the monster. And it's incredibly sweet and totally beautiful.
It is.
Really, really brilliant film. Yeah. So if you don't want kind of, you know, violence and gore, there's loads of other kind of Frankenstein versions out there.
Thank you both so much for coming onto the show and for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was great. Really good to talk to you, Sarah and Aisha, about this.
Yeah, same.
Great. Next episode, we will be talking about a film which is 1 year before Frankenstein. That is Just Imagine from 1930. Why am I going backwards? Because this film was suggested to me by Lisa Yazyk, who was from episode one. I spoke to her, and I'm not a fan of musicals, but I was intrigued and I watched it and I decided we definitely have to cover it. So more on the show notes where you can watch that, and join me again next time. Please like, subscribe, and share with your friends. Thank you so much.